Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hi, welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we have the good fortune of speaking with Rick Rule, one of the best-known natural resources investors alive today. He spent the past 35 years investing in mining, energy, water, forest products, infrastructure, agriculture, and founded the successful Global Resource Investment Group of companies, which was acquired last year by the Sprott Group. And as you know, I've interviewed Eric Sprott here before as well. Rick and I just met recently at the Casey Research Conference in Phoenix earlier this year, and it felt a little bit like reuniting with a brother who'd been separated at birth because we see the world through such a similar lens. I'm very excited to dive deeply today into the resources space because you know how important that is to me with such an experienced mind. Rick, hey, it's a real pleasure to have you join us today.
Well, my pleasure. As you point out, I enjoyed your speech very much at Casey Summit. It felt like you gave the first half of my speech, but unfortunately you gave it better than I could have, so it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, very nice of you to say that. It's a speech I've been practicing for a while. I guess it was at the Hard Assets Investment Conference in San Francisco. I hear you detailed out your thoughts on the good news and the bad news facing investors today. Can you dive right in? Can you give us the quick highlights of that?
Yeah, I think I can. I talked about the fact that we were going to face an awful lot of volatility. And I should start by saying that volatility can be good news for you if you're prepared for it. It gives you frequent sales. Why the volatility? In the first instance, there's $7 or $8 trillion sitting on the sidelines, just in the United States, looking to be invested. That has some upward bias. The second part of the good news, I think, is that we are in a secular bull market in stuff, in resources, for reasons that you've done a great job pointing out. But let's back up on a few of them. The bottom of the demographic pyramid, as it gets richer, and it is getting a bit richer, uses a lot more stuff than the top of the pyramid. So per capita consumption of stuff is growing, spread over lots and lots and lots of capitas. The third thing that I tried to point out in San Francisco, and I'm sure some of your veteran investors are familiar with, is that resource stocks have not kept pace with commodity prices. So resource stocks, for the first time in several years, are attractively priced. Mm-hmm. That's the good news. The bad news is also pretty straightforward. It appears to me like we are headed towards a liquidity or credit crisis as a consequence of the fact that the political will doesn't exist to cause the citizenry of Western nations to live within their means, and because the banking system, as we know it, is bankrupt. An example would be Germany, the lender of last resort for the European Economic Community, had a failed bond auction. Mm-hmm. If the lender of last resort can't lend, you have a fairly interesting set of circumstances. Of course, they did find another lender of last resort. That's us.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the market hasn't seemed to figure out that we're in some danger of going broke ourselves. So I think there's plenty of good news and plenty of bad news for everybody.
Yeah, so this liquidity crisis, though, you have maybe two competing theses going here. One is that, yes, we have this large tailwind, demographically speaking, with resources. That's on one side propelling us upward, but wouldn't a liquidity crisis be sort of arguing that we will be facing some sort of an economic crunch, maybe another recession, maybe something harder that would drive resource price down?
I think that might happen. I'm completely conversant with the fact that resource stocks could get cheaper before they get expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You're a good mathematician, and you know that you have a mean line and a median line because things don't revert to mean or median. They revert through the line.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that stuff has gotten cheap probably means it gets cheaper. But the nature of investing in natural resources is investing on a net present value basis, not on a relevant value basis. And the stuff is cheap. We don't see it cheap very often. Back to your question. Yeah, you have two countervailing pieces of data. $7 or $8 trillion of cash looking to be invested at the same time that some of the institutional sources of debt funding, i.e. the banks, are shutting down interbank lending and short-term credit is becoming very hard to get, which is often a portent that long-term credit will become unavailable.
Yeah, you know, there's a very interesting dynamic here. If I'm somebody with a relatively large pool of money plus a longish term time horizon, I'm a pension fund, I'm an endowment, I'm a sovereign wealth fund, I'm somebody, I would be looking at the resource plays very, very carefully here, in large part because, you know, the MF Global disaster, what we see going on in the banks, the idea that the Fed hid $7.7 trillion of emergency loans to these institutions. I'm just looking for some place where I can park my funds, hopefully on a net present value basis that's favorable. But I'm looking to park my funds somewhere where I can trust that no matter what happens out there, that I've got a steady stream of cash, I'm invested in a real asset that has tangible wealth that I can identify. I'm surprised, given those $7.7 trillion floating around out there, that more of them haven't tried to squeeze through what I can consider to be a pretty tiny doorway.
I think it's a matter of time, and I guess I have a little more good news that I should have talked about at the onset, which is that the senior resource companies, including the mining companies that have been real underperformers for the last decade, are starting to make an awful lot of money. And one of the themes I think that you're going to see in the resource space is mergers and acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
I think the best trade that can be made in particularly the developing and junior resource space, is to buy shares in companies that won't be bought by fund managers and that won't be bought, in fact, by endowments, but will be bought by industry players.
Mm.
So in terms of who can come into the space, by all means, the pension funds that you're talking about, by all means, the individual investors who have all the money in now accounts, but particularly, I think, by other industry players.
Right. Right. I mean, we've certainly seen that happen in the oil industry, and that's sort of a maturation story that's happening there. And as you know, we, over here on my side of the camp, we tend to see the current economic crisis. It's rooted in this larger story of depletion of the key inputs modern economies just need to function, most notably oil. So you know about peak oil. I'm wondering, how does peak oil or peak anything fit into your strategy for investing?
Well, peak oil in the geological context is something that will absolutely happen. But I think you need to look at peak oil in an economic context. We have passed peak oil in the $60 or $65 a barrel real range,
mm-hmm.
never mind the nominal range where the value of the denominator goes down.
Yeah.
I don't think we've passed or even reached peak $150 oil. I think one of the lessons that people need to understand is that in time frames which are relevant to you and I,
mm-hmm.
markets work. And high oil prices will constrain demand and increase supply. One of the things, however, that people need to understand is that $95 oil now isn't the same as $95 10 years ago, because the dollar isn't the same as it was. Looking forward, the challenge that we face in conventional energy markets isn't peak oil. The challenge that we face is the fact that most of the oil in the world is produced by national oil companies, by the same sort of government entities that can't deliver the mail and can't educate the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And in several large oil exporting countries now, I'm speaking specifically about Venezuela, Mexico, Ecuador, Peru, Indonesia, and probably Iran, the national governments have diverted so much of the sustaining capital from their oil industry to subsidize politically expedient domestic spending programs that they are in declines that can't be arrested for 5 years or 7 years or 10 years. It is my belief that within 5 years, at least 20% of the crude oil, which is currently available for export on an annual basis, comes off the market. And unless Libya and Iraq can make up that shortfall, you're going to have a market that sees world import demand growing by 2.5% compounded walk into a supply side where supplies are 20% less, which would have a dramatic increase, impact on prices in the 3 to 5 year time frame. Looking further out, certainly peak oil from the point of view of geological capacity is an issue, but we're going to face a different problem before we have to face that problem.
Sure. So we're past peak cheap oil or cheaper grades of oil. We've got that. And your 20% would, I think there's about 35 million barrels a day goes on the world export market. So you're talking, you've sort of calculated a 7-8 million barrel per day shortfall, running headlong into probably a 2 or 3 million barrel per day increase, over that same period of time. So we've got the pieces brewing there. I've seen the same thing in my own calculations and what's up. And all that we really need is for one of these nationalized oil companies to say, hold on, we're saving this stuff for our own country, maybe Norway. I don't know, somebody. I don't think Iraq and Libya can come online fast enough. They would have to increase production. They would have to both double their production from current levels. Neither of them can do that.
And, you know, Chris, one of the ironic follow-ons to that is that one of the things that these national governments do, ironically, that cannibalizes capital from their oil business is they subsidize domestic energy consumption. So, as an example, in both Venezuela and Mexico, on the one hand, the national oil companies are constraining supply as a consequence of their diverting free working capital. And ironically, on the other hand, one of the things that they're using the money for is stimulating domestic demand mm-hmm. by subsidizing energy consumption. It's a fairly ugly circumstance in terms of world oil supply on a going forward basis.
Yeah, that's two exponential functions sort of pinching together, one from above, one from below, taking oil off the market. So, somebody who's 22 years old today has been alive when half of all the oil ever burned in history has been burned. And so you've been in business and looking across resource plays for 35 years. I'm wondering, what are the trends that you've seen in terms of the quality of the resource plays that you can identify over your career? And I don't care what resource we're talking about, whatever ones you're familiar with. Are we still finding ample supplies of high-quality ores? Or are we really squinting at these things and chasing stuff in the lower and lower grams per ton or however we're measuring these things these days?
Well, again, markets work. I think the easy-to-find deposits, particularly in the minerals business, ones that stick out of the ground, mm-hmm. In pieces of ground that are safe to walk on, mm-hmm. those are gone. If we're going to find deposits that outcrop, that is, stick out of the ground, we're going to find them in places like Somalia and Afghanistan, Bolivia, hard places. There are high-quality deposits to be found, but they're going to require more and more expensive exploration techniques, ground-penetrating radar and things like that. And the same with oil and gas. We are, here in the United States, reversing long-term trends in terms of both oil and gas production. But we are not doing it in a conventional sense. We're doing it in an unconventional sense. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the sort of conjunction of three technologies, amplitude versus offset, three-dimensional seismic, directional drilling, and multi-stage fracturing. And we are doing really, truly a tremendous job of unlocking American energy. But we're doing it at very, very, very high capital cost. If you compare the development cost for Bakken oil relative to the development cost of some of the Permian Basin pools that were discovered in the 50s, there's no relationship between production costs. What we're doing is wonderful, but as you pointed out in an earlier question, this is not low-cost oil. All oil's good, but these are hard, hard deposits to develop from a financial point of view.
I've heard that the average Bakken well is paying out at about 150 barrels per day, which isn't bad when you say it's $100 a barrel. Not that you can sell Bakken oil for that right now, but sake of argument, make the numbers easy. That's not insignificant, but you compare that to a Ghawar oil well that might pay out at 30,000 barrels per day or some ridiculous number like that.
Sure.
It's a flow rate issue as well. It's not just they're more capital intensive, but peak oil is really about the peak flow rate we're going to hit as well, and these plays just require an extraordinary number of wells to just maintain what we would consider to be a reasonable flow rate.
And, Chris, you're starting to see this in the gas business. One of the things about these multi-stage horizontal wells is that the initial flow rates that the industry tends to get from them are spectacular, but they suffer exponential declines.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is, and we've seen this on the gas side, not on the oil side yet, that as long as the forward strip in natural gas, that is the price that producers can sell gas forward on for 2 years or 3 years, is sufficient to pay out the well in 12 or 18 months of flush production, the industry will drill the well. Once they have their capital back, after they've suffered the exponential declines, the continuing operating costs are fairly low.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw an incredible explosion of gas drilling, even dry gas drilling, 3 or 4 years ago when the forward strip was in the $6 or $7 range, because the initial flush production could come on, the producers could sell into the forward strip, pay the well off in 12 to 18 months, and then have an annuity from a paid off well over time. Now that the natural gas price has fallen fairly substantially and the forward strip is flat, what you're seeing is a tremendous reduction in the rig count for natural gas wells, with the exception of wells in the liquids-rich window in the Marcellus and in Eagle Ford, mm-hmm. where there is enough heavy liquids in the gas stream that the dry gas is in effect for free. But in terms of the dry gas, the things like the Barnett that were very, very, very active 5 years ago, the rig count there has really fallen off.
What's the rough break even on a MCF basis there for gas?
You know, the industry is going to tell you that they can break even. A lot of them can break even at $3.50 a thousand. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's right. I think a fully loaded break even in the gas business, dry gas business with no liquids, is more like $5 a thousand.
Hmm.
Because you are starting to see, not starting to see, you have witnessed in the last 12 months a dramatic shift of rigs available to drill in dry gas locales to wet gas locales.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the corresponding number is going to be in the oil business. It's going to take a little while longer before we have a type curve, a depletion type curve, in the liquids part of the Eagle Ford, up in the Bakken, and in the Niobrara. We don't know enough about how the type curves, the decline curves, are going to work in those fields so that we understand what an economic well is at various price points. But we'll understand that in the next 18 months.
Right. And so the general story here is that there is a decent amount of oil. Obviously, there's some issues around fracking, some concerns there for some locales. But the bottom line is that we're going to be drilling thousands of wells where we used to drill hundreds of wells. I mean, there's just a whole order of magnitude increase in the activity, and I just want people to think of the capital involved in that, the amount of steel, the amount of high technology, the amount of labor. All of that actually is just means that it's there, it's useful, it's an exploitable energy source, but it's not really directly comparable to what we were pulling out of, as you mentioned, the Permian Basin in the 50s.
Quite right. Now, the interesting thing for investors is that for investors who care to study, in some senses, this new technique makes them better investments because it is easier to develop a risk-adjusted net present value calculation for a company that has 600 proved undeveloped locations,
mm-hmm.
where you understand their decline curve, their type curve, than it is to estimate success in the exploration business, which is what we used to do. Ironically, although the cost structure of the business is getting worse as a consequence of the development costs, the finding costs are coming out of the equation. So for investors who understand the nature of these resource plays, there is fairly certain money to be made in a volatile market.
Hmm.
When the market price of a company falls substantially below the discounted net present value of the future cash flows of proved undeveloped locations, these companies go on extraordinary sale, and they go on sale with a high degree of probability of success. It's a very interesting set of circumstances where, although in some senses the industry fundamentals have deteriorated, the industry's attractiveness to intelligent, hardworking speculators has increased. It's very ironic, and it's very pleasant.
Yeah, interesting. So you've got a number of these on your radar screen, I assume?
We do.
Excellent.
We do. Securities laws prevent me from sharing them. You know,
I understand that.
As a consequence of being securities licensed, I can talk about anything as long as it's not really useful.
All right, so let's generalize this. So which natural resource sectors then interest you the most right now?
I'm interested across the barrel, but I think particularly interested in sub 500 million market cap resource plays in the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin. That is Canadian listed
mm-hmm.
Companies with repeatable resource plays in oil. I am also very, very, very attracted to the uranium space as a consequence of the events in Japan. The uranium space got cut in half, but uranium consumption hasn't budged. So I like the risk-to-reward juxtaposition in uranium. What really has me excited right now, however, is that for the second time in the last 10 years, the smaller gold stocks are attractively priced relative to the gold price. You know, Chris, I found myself in the embarrassing position in 2010 to be a fairly well-known gold stock broker that didn't have any gold stock recommendations.
Yep.
As a consequence of the fact that the gold stocks were assuming very, very, very high gold prices, but weren't putting on very good corporate performances. We've seen the situation now where the bullion prices continued to go up, but the share prices of the stocks have got absolutely creamed. So what is probably most attractive to me of all are the shares of the pre-feasibility stage junior companies and some of the smaller producers that have large organic development pipelines. We think that they are absolutely cheap, and that's something that doesn't happen very often.
Right, and so they got hammered for a variety of reasons, including share dilution and mysterious lack of free cash flows from what should have been a really incredible environment. You think those have reversed somewhat now?
It's interesting. I think it has. You know, I was, as you may know, a very vociferous critic of the sector for the last 10 years, particularly the senior producers. I expected, like many people did, when the product price went from $250 an ounce to $1,500 an ounce, the free cash flows should absolutely soar, but they forgot to do it. And yeah. What has interested me is that really just in the last 2 years, the incredible amount of capital that the industry has forced into mine development has begun to pay off. And by all measures now, the senior gold mining companies, which were absolute cash-generating laggards, have turned into truly spectacular cash cows. And this is useful from a couple of fronts. The major mining companies have begun to be confident enough in their cash-generating capabilities that they are returning some of it to the owners in the face of dividends and share buybacks. But the other thing is that it allows them, gives them the ability and, in fact, the need to buy new deposits from discoverers and developers and often finance these acquisitions and finance the development of the undeveloped deposits with cash that they have on hand rather than cash that they have to raise either from shareholders or financial institutions. It's a truly virtuous circle, and it's a virtuous circle that has happened at a time when the share prices are reasonable, and to me, that's a particularly pleasant conjunction of circumstance.
Well, that puts them at odds with a lot of corporate share buybacks, which tend to happen at rather inopportune moments, like all-time highs and things like that. So
right.
that's always a nice thing. Now, this is beginning to sound suspiciously like true fundamental analysis, where you really dive in and you look at a company. Can you walk us through what your process is when you're investigating a company and you say this is somebody we want to put money with or buy shares of? What's your process?
Sure. You know, for many years I've been a bridge and mezzanine lender, and I tend to look at these things from a lender's point of view. So for me, the market capitalization of a company is really only of interest after I've tried to establish what I think the value of the company is. And what works in my world is net present value. Let's say, as an example, that a company has a gold deposit and a bankable feasibility study that says that they have 1 million recoverable ounces.
Yep.
And that they are going to produce these ounces, to keep the math simple, at 100,000 ounces a year for 10 years. It's going to cost $400 million to build this mine, and they will produce the gold at $500 cash cost per ounce. So if we assume, again, to keep the math simple, that gold is selling for $1,500 an ounce, you have a sense that in the the first year you're going to produce 1 million ounces at 1,500, or put a different way, you're going to have a cash margin of $1,000 an ounce on 100,000 ounces.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep the math simple, let's just suggest that you don't escalate the gold price and you don't escalate the costs. In fact, you do escalate both, and a bankable feasibility study will do that in some fashion for you. But it's really a simple measure of taking out that $1,000 an ounce margin on 100,000 ounces and discounting the 10 years of cash flow back at whatever interest rate you believe is appropriate. Some people use the 30-year treasury rate. Some people use 10% for ease, whichever discount rate you think is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a net present value number. You subtract the capital cost and the sustaining capital costs, and the number that you have left over after you've recouped your capital and paid interest charges, if any, on your capital, is the net present value number. There are other methodologies that other people use. As an example, a much simpler calculation, which many people use, is in situ value. That is, how many recoverable ounces the company has divided by market cap. I think that's an illusory number. It's
Yep.
easy to calculate, but it doesn't take into account the capital cost to develop the ounce, or the operating cost per ounce produced, or the time value of money. It values ounces produced 15 years from now at the same value that an ounce which would be produced tomorrow is valued at. So although it's a simple number, it's an illusory number. For me, net present value is what matters. And when you have the net present value number, you have to discount that, too, by the general and administrative expense that the company will have to pay on a going-forward basis. But if you find a company with a net present value, that is net of capital expenditures, of, say, $1 billion, that's on sale in the market for $350 million, you have a reasonable chance of seeing an industry buyer come in and pay $700 million for that $1 billion in net present value so that they can earn an acceptable return on the surplus over and above. And we're in market conditions right now where those types of valuations, in fact, abound in the sub-$1 billion and more spectacularly in the sub-$500 million marketplace.
Oh, interesting. So, and this is across the various resource plays that we talked about before. You're seeing this pretty generally in the resource area, or is this concentrated anywhere at this point?
No, I'm seeing it pretty much across the board. I'm attracted to the values in the gold business because I think the gold price is going higher. The undervaluation is more ubiquitous in the oil and gas business, and I think the valuations are more certain in the oil and gas business. But certainly we're seeing these sets of circumstances occur across the market.
And are you constraining your analysis to, let me say, just how do I put this politely, geopolitically stable areas to take that risk
well,
off the table?
You know, Chris, I have a different definition of geopolitically stable than most people do.
Hmm.
I live in the People's Republic of California,
yeah.
And I would regard my home state as an extremely risky place
uh-huh.
to do natural resource development. When most people talk about geopolitically risky places, they talk about frontier markets. I've done a lot of investing in frontier markets, and I have to say that I have been treated just as poorly in California as I was in Congo. The difference is that a place like Congo needs mining. So in some senses, political risk is a function of how much you are paid to take it. I would certainly prefer an extraordinarily good deposit in a bad place to a bad deposit in a good place. Better yet, of course, would be a good deposit in a good place, but that doesn't happen often unless you are in an extremely, extremely bad equity market and don't have the courage for it.
Interesting. So here we are. You know, one of my views right now is that actually there's relatively little investing being done these days by most people. It's just speculating. So anybody who's invested in an index fund, a general S&P index fund, or an ETF that's broadly across a huge sector, I think is largely speculating. And here's why. Nobody knows what the Federal Reserve or the ECB is going to do next week, how much money they're going to dump in. Is it going to be $1 trillion or $10 trillion? We don't know. You know, and so on that sense, there's a little bit of speculating going on. But you're talking about a world of investing that makes a lot of sense. So let's imagine you're an average investor and you're just trying to make it through the next decade, you know, without your wealth evaporating somehow. How appropriate do you think are the resource investment opportunities at Global Resource Sprott for the average investor?
I think they're extremely appropriate. One of the things that we can do is tailor a portfolio to people according to the risk appetite that, A, they profess, and, B, we think is appropriate for them. There are real values in the resource sector. And the other thing I think is that the average investor is still relatively underweighted in resources as a consequence of the fact that this market really didn't get started till 2005. The period 1982 to 2005 were markets that were generally not favorable for resource investors, although they were very nice to me. And as a consequence, people haven't yet been trained to look in the resource space. So from the point of view of portfolio allocation or risk allocation, most people are underweighted in resources, which I think is ironic given the fact that I think the broad outlook for the resource and raw material sector is probably better than the outlook for the broad market.
Yeah, I agree with that. And much of this, I think, I get the question all the time. People are just flat out confused how they even would invest in the resource space. So I think that there's just a little bit of learning curve to go through here for all concerned. This has been a fascinating conversation because I totally agree with you. The main summary, of course, jives with my own, which is that I think we crossed the 7 billion threshold mark for humans on the planet. And as you mentioned, most of those are desperately trying to get up the living standard curve, and that, of course, requires resources. And so I just, you know, no matter how many ways I tilt this cube and look at it and squint at it, I can't find a way to suggest anything other than there's going to be increasing competition for what I see to be a steadily dwindling pool in both quantity and quality of high-grade resources. So there it is. And for those who are looking to learn more about your work and the solutions that Global Resource Investment and Sprott can offer, where can they go?
Visit us on the web at www.sprottglobal, that's sprottglobal.com, or call us here at 800-477-7853.
All right. Well, I hope people do, because you guys are the best, and you've just been doing this a long time, and it's good, solid, fundamental analysis, which is something I just believe in, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed that it comes back in style at some point, because that's how things should be, and I truly believe in the resource story, and so for people who can get involved in that, I still, to this day, think that there's still a first mover advantage in this space. I believe that $7 trillion hasn't quite figured this story out yet. It will, and some portion of that will migrate over through what I consider to be a relatively tiny doorway. And we'll find out whether that's right or not, I believe, in the next few years.
I couldn't agree more.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, and I hope we get to do this again.
I look forward to it.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.